Hey Carnivore Theology listeners, we have a brand new contest for you. We now have Carnivore Theology t-shirts for sale with no profit to us. To buy a shirt, go to the website www.carnivoretheology.com and click on that big t-shirt. To enter the contest, just post any picture of you wearing a Carnivore Theology shirt with the hashtag Carnivore Theology Shirt on any social media site like Facebook. The prize for this contest is a gift card to Dairy Queen so you can enjoy both milk and meat. For every picture, you will get one entry. If you take a picture of yourself wearing the shirt in a church, that's two entries. If you're wearing the shirt on a Sunday at your church and you can prove it's a Sunday, that's three entries. Five, if you take a picture with your shirt and your pastor. 10, if you get your pastor and you wearing a Carnivore Theology shirt together in a picture, that's 10. And lastly, 50. If you can wear your Carnivore Theology shirt on stage during a sermon, that's 50 entries. The contest will close April 1st of 2015. So get your pictures posted with hashtag Carnivore Theology Shirt, and we look forward to seeing all the pictures posted. Welcome to Carnivore Theology, a podcast that answers questions about the Christian faith to help you grow from milk to meat into wise, skilled, world-changing followers of Jesus Christ. With theologian and pastor Chad Graham, author and pastor Al Desjardins, and me, your host, Steve Bastian. Today's question is, how should we as Christians respond to 50 Shades of Grey movie and book? So how long until the bus comes, guys?
I don't know. It should have been here by now.
I hope it comes soon. I'm cold.
You really should be wearing a jacket.
But I want people to see my awesome Carnivore Theology t-shirt. We're all wearing them.
Yeah, baby. And we look like some kind of meat-related sports team.
That's not a bad thing. Exactly. Hey, there's the bus! All right!
Yay, bus!
Woohoo!
After you?
Here you go, my good man.
Can I borrow a dollar? They hiked the price again.
Oh, for the love.
Again?
Yeah. Okay, let's sit in the back. Don't forget to count. We're at 14. Don't look like you're counting. Don't forget to count.
There's one!
15 perverts.
Okay, there's two more, and a billboard, and a poster.
So is that 17 or 19? Are we counting just the books?
Just the books.
17.
Don't look like you're counting the books. Why would you say that? Never mind, ma'am. It's fine.
Let's just sit here. I can't believe how popular 50 Shades of Grey is. We're here on a city bus in downtown Calgary, on our way to the Conservatory Butterfly Garden at the Calgary Zoo, and we're counting how many times we see people reading the book in public. The numbers are staggering. You know, Al, I know that you did some research on this recently in preparation for a sermon. What's all of this about?
Tell you, I cannot wait to get to the Butterfly Conservatory so I can get this all out of my mind and, you know, switch to the terror of possibly having a bug land on me. but at least it'll be distracting. But think about this, okay, guys? This week, just in time for Valentine's Day, a movie called 50 Shades of Grey will be released in major theaters all around the world. This movie is based on a book of the same name. The book was the number one best-selling book of 2012, the number two best-selling book of 2013. In some markets, it outpaced Harry Potter for how fast it sold.
No way.
As of today, yeah, it's true. As of today, the movie trailer has more than 51 million views. On Friday when I checked, it had 48. It's on track to make $60 million on its opening weekend. To give you a perspective of what that means, that's the territory of the Lego movie, Star Wars 1, and many of the Marvel movies. Okay?
Wait, which one is Star Wars 1? The crummy one with Jar Jar?
Star Wars 1, yeah, a crummy one with Jar Jar.
Okay,
exactly.
One.
Yeah. Both the book and the movie are classified as erotica. Okay, but without question, it is pornography. There are anti-pornography and sexual exploitation groups that are going crazy over this. They've been working hard to try to get the film boycotted or at least given a stronger adult rating. the deal, and the reason that so many groups are speaking out against this movie is that even though there have been lots of movies with a sexual theme in the past, this is what I would consider, and many are considering, the most dangerous of them by far. I took some time this week to read some chapter analyses from a website that was set up by a professional therapist and an abuse victim who takes each section apart and looks at the book each chapter by chapter, explaining all the damage being done. I managed to make it about halfway through chapter 8 before I had to quit. It was some of the most disturbing stuff I've ever read. So let me give you a description of what the End Sexual Exploitation website says to summarize this book.
Okay? Just before you go on, I'm just looking at my book here, and I'm wondering, I'm actually not familiar with that category. What does that actually mean?
What? Erotica?
Erotica.
Yeah, erotica essentially is literature that is meant to sexually excite.
It's like a term for pornography.
It is a term for pornography. Okay. They're almost synonymous.
Like, so written pornography.
Basically, yeah. You can have movies that are erotica. Oh. They'll say, like, this movie is erotica. It's rated R, but don't worry, it's not pornography, right? Which is rated X kind of thing. So it's
sort of softer pornography? Yeah. Okay. Right.
So let me read you this summary. It says this. The 50 Shades trilogy follows wealthy and powerful businessman Christian Grey as he meets Anastasia Steele, a virginal college student lacking in confidence, and woos her into his BDSM, sexual sadism, and torture sex world of the Red Room of Pain. The relationship maps onto what would be considered an abusive relationship, rife with domestic violence in the real world. Christian puts Anna under contract to serve as a sexual submissive and uses intimidation, coercion, humiliation, violence, stalking, manipulation, jealousy, and other controlling behaviors to groom Anna and keep her under his domination. The franchise advertises it as a love affair and erotic sex. What it's really about is abuse and violence.
So now, that was written by who?
That was written by End Sexual Exploitation.
Okay.
The group, okay? Now, there's two big, huge themes. The reason that this is so exciting to people and so damned by so many others is for two reasons. Let me just give you a quick summary of what those two reasons are before, just so we can get an understanding of what we're talking about, okay?
Why do we even need to know why it was damned? You could already tell it.
I know. Okay, number one, and this is something that has been surprising the Christian subculture, you might call it, is that this book and movie have given rise to a new subgenre of erotica that people are calling mommy porn. Okay, so married conservative Christian women with kids, many of whom are not nominal Christians, but what you would consider to be your Sunday school teacher and your, you know, your deaconess in your church, the same ones that are buying Bible studies, and this is statistically true, they're also buying and reading 50 Shades of Grey in record numbers. They're crazy for this book.
Okay, so their Amazon front page must be very confusing. Recommended for you based on your browsing history.
Yeah, exactly. So, and now the second one is more disturbing, and what this is showing as it's being more accepted by Christian women, as it's being more accepted into culture, and some feminists are championing this book as a great win for their thinking, which blows my mind, is what they're calling the rape myth. And this, the 50 Shades is directly connected to something that they're calling the rape myth. Now, what is that, you ask? Well, people are learning that exposure to pornography is normalizing rape and violence towards women. Let me just throw a few quotes, which I happen to have on my phone here, since I knew this would come up. It says that the National Center on Sexual Exploitation says this: the porn industry has poised men and women to receive the message that sexual violence is enjoyable. Feminist Robin Morgan has an even more apt quote. She said this: pornography is the theory and rape is the practice. Now, let me share with you the quote that really hits this home, okay?
Don't do it! Don't do it!
Dr. Mary Ann Layden, who's the Director of Sexual Trauma and Psychopathology in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania, says this: the perpetrators of rape and prostitution and pornography and child molestation are in a common set of beliefs. And when we look at the research, we can see some of those common beliefs, so that we know that individuals who are exposed to the pornographic media have beliefs such as thinking that rape victims like to be raped, they don't suffer much when they're raped, She got what she wanted when she was raped. Women make false accusations of rape because it isn't really rape. Sex is either good or great, and there isn't any other option other than good or great. No one is really traumatized by it. All of these are part of the rape myth. People who use pornography accept the rape myth to a greater degree than others. So we have a sense that pornography is teaching them to think like a rapist and then triggering them to act like rapists. That is what this freaking book is all about. If you strip away the glamour and the fancy suits and all the rest of that stuff, this movie is about a wealthy misogynist who psychologically manipulates a young girl into a domestic abuse situation full of physical and emotional violence and rape. And women can't wait. Even Christian women cannot wait to watch it. That's where we're at.
That's disturbing.
The part that I struggle with, I do know people who have read this book. Some Christians, some non-Christians. How do I respond to people that have read this book? How do I engage in this conversation to try to explain that this might not be a good thing for them?
Well, I'm shocked by how many people find this acceptable. It blows my mind that they do, and most of them. In fact, an interesting story, online on Facebook, I put on that I was preaching on this on Sunday, so, you know, watch out for it, and, you know, don't bring your kids, make sure you send them to Sunday school kind of thing. And a woman that I hadn't talked to in about 2 years, so I'm related to, that's why she's on there, she just shows up and she's like, what are you talking about? Why are you talking against 50 Shades? There's no rape in it. What are you talking about? It's all consensual.
Oh.
And I'm like, actually, there absolutely is rape in it, and here's the evidence of it. And I said, go read these summaries and you'll see it, you know, as described by a psychologist and abuse victim. You have no question. Well, you can't talk about that, and it's just an alternative lifestyle. And what surprised me the most is that this woman would self-identify as a baptized Christian.
Well, pastorally, this whole thing disturbs me. But personally, I knew that it was out there, but I didn't really understand it. You ended up sending me those links to that lady who did that review. And I found it even fascinating that she had some direct quotes from the book, which were enough to dissuade me from ever wanting to read any more of it. But she was talking about how the book itself, even whatever term she used, even misrepresents the BDSM culture and makes it more vulgar and worse. So you already have something that is pretty aberrant. And then the book takes it and makes an aberration of the aberrant and then glorifies it as good.
Well, and that's one of the weird, ironic things about it, is that even the BDSM community, which is a weird thing for me to even be saying, doesn't like that book either because it misrepresents them.
My good friends in the BDSM community are all against it.
I know.
Yeah. Basically, Steve told me it was bad, so...
Yeah, there you go.
This is the kind of topic, in all seriousness, that I can't believe that we actually have to talk about with Christians. Of course, we expect these kind of things in the world. But to me, from a pastoral perspective, there's one critical thing, and that is just in understanding the nature of sin. And from reading through that review site that you gave me, I got a pretty good sense of the story of the book. And it actually looks to me like this girl's story, this Anastasia story, is actually kind of an allegory for the nature of sin itself. She's not young, she's impressionable. Not intentionally, I'm sure, yeah, but she's young, she's impressionable, she's taken in by this powerful and enticing figure. And the clips that were in there, she's afraid, she's intimidated by what she's saying, but at the same time, she's enticed and feels a sense of necessity behind what's going to happen and a sense of thrill at what's going to happen at the same time that it's a bit repulsive and fearful. And that's actually the way that many people talk about sin.
You read about in the book the dichotomy in her mind of her morality or her fear, and you'll read also about this thing called the inner goddess, which stands in for her libido. She is drawn by sexual sin, and she's drawn by her inner goddess to release this, and you can feel the tension between, I want to get out of here, this is horrible and gross and demeaning, and I don't understand it, and I want to get out, and my inner goddess, which is the lust towards, you know, sexuality and curiosity, and you can kind of feel the battle, and what wins out is the lust.
And we know that's true because Scripture teaches us, Jesus himself teaches us, that whoever commits a sin is a slave to that sin which they commit. I've been studying Romans 7 and 8 and preaching on that in my church, and one of the things that it talks about so much is that those who are in the flesh live according to the flesh, and cannot do the things that please God. They're powerless. They're enslaved to sin. And even Christians struggle a huge struggle with the power of sin. And I really saw that as I was reading those clips and that analysis of the storyline in the book. This is a person who is completely consumed in sin. And what I think that should push back on us as we think from a Christian perspective is the very deceitful nature of sin. In the garden, the serpent said, you'll be like God. You'll be free. The serpent promised salvation from God's constraints, but he delivered damnation. And right through to today, that's exactly the way that sin is. Eve looked up at the tree and saw the fruit was desirable, and she wanted it. And yet, taking the fruit destroyed her. You know, it's been said that sin thrills, and then it kills. Or it charms, and then it harms. The idea is it's very, very true. Sin is very enticing. Sin brings a sense of pleasure, and then sin enslaves. And we read in Romans 6:23, the wages of sin is death. That's a beautiful word picture. It's not a picture for you live as a sinner and one day you die and you go and get into judgment. No, no, no. What it's saying is it's using a word that is used for a day labor. And it's saying day in, day out, sin is paying out little by little a piece of death. And the more that we fall into sin, the more death is dealt to us. And death, in biblical terms, isn't the cessation of animal life. Death in biblical terms is separation from God, separation from blessing, and separation from humanness. Death is being moved outside the garden. Death is being sent into outer darkness. Death is being sent away from the presence of God and his glory and his blessings. And death is being sent away from the source of true life. And so the wage that sin is paying is making us a little less human, a little more enslaved, and a little more dead every day. And when death brings forth its fruit, it results in physical death and spiritual death and the second death. And if you're a Christian and you're looking at this kind of thing, you need to realize that this is something not to toy with. Paul puts it this way: to set the mind on the flesh is death, but to set the mind on the spirit is life and peace. For the mind that is set on the flesh is hostile to God, at war with him. It doesn't submit to God's law. Indeed, it cannot. And those who are in the flesh cannot please God. Christians, however, he says, are not in the flesh, but in the Spirit. If, in fact, the Spirit of God dwells in you. And then this powerful statement. Anyone who doesn't have the Spirit of Christ doesn't belong to him. The Spirit can't live in these things. What it's drawing a contrast for us here is that if you are set to the inner goddess, the desire to fulfill the lusts of the flesh, and that's the compass point of your life, you don't have the Spirit of God. If you're a Christian, your compass point is righteousness in the Spirit, but you'll still struggle with sin. In fact, the very next verse says, if Christ is in you, although the body is dead because of sin, the Spirit is life because of righteousness. And if you've read Romans 7, you see Paul's personal struggle universified. That which I do not wish to do, that I do, and that which I wish to do, I do not do. So I find two laws present in me. A desire to do good and to serve God in my spirit, and yet in my flesh another law principle that wages war against the spirit. So Christians do the battle. We want to be battling, but you cannot. And when I see the Christian women buying these books, reading through the series, dwelling in it, living in it, thinking in it, they are setting their minds on the flesh. And so what I'm saying is, pastorally, you can't toy with this.
No, yeah, there's some proverb that talks about, can you pour hot coals into your lap and not get burned? And the whole proverb is, what do you expect, right? You're reminding me of James chapter 1, verse 14, which says,
yes,
a person is tempted when they're dragged away by their own evil desire and enticed. Being enticed, being tempted, is not a sin, but it is that which is in you that you desire, that wants to get out, that wants to experience that. And then after the desire has conceived, James 1:15, it gives birth to sin. And so we got to be real careful with these desires. They're twisting healthy desires. Satan is twisting healthy desires, which sexuality is good. God loves us enough to give us the gift of sex. Submitting to your husband is a good thing. Loving your wife is a good thing. Exchanging physical love is a good thing. But then Satan twists it and twists all these things to be evil. Women and men get very curious about it, and then that leads them to death. It leads them to death. And that desire is not a bad thing until it's twisted
exactly
twisted to death. Like, it blows my mind when I think about this. I read in the first one of the first chapters, or the chapter summaries, where it talked about making love. Christian, the main character, he actually says, "I don't make love. I, you know, beep." And he he says this to Anastasia because he wants to make sure he knows that this is not about love. It's not about emotional connection. This is just, you know, purely physical, raw desire. And it's not even about you, Anastasia. It's about me and my desires. And I intend to use you. But because she is a virgin, he decides, well, we're going to make love first so you can see what it's all about. And it blows my mind that that term is in there and that people would actually use the term making love to describe any kind of sadistic torture sex type situation as an alternative way to make love. Because if you think of the definition of love from Scripture, okay, it's exactly the opposite. 1 Corinthians 13, love is patient and kind. Love does not envy or boast. It is not arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice at wrongdoing, but rejoices with the truth. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never ends. Now, when we look at this pornography, when we read this erotica, it's exactly the opposite. And yet, women and men are drawn to this because I think almost because it's exactly the opposite. It is not patient. It is not kind. In fact, it's full of pride and selfishness and rudeness. The whole thing is about insisting on its own way. That's the driving force of pornography. That's the driving force of violent fantasy books. Mm-hmm. I want pleasure, and I'm going to hurt you to get it. I've heard people actually call themselves Christians rejoicing in the wrongdoing of this book. It is the opposite of love.
You guys have kind of answered this question, but the harm of reading a book about someone else's sexual experiences when that sexual experience doesn't line up with God's plan and his perfect intentions. It's just like watching violent movies every day. You're filling your mind with violence. You're going to find yourself being violent. I worked in the oil and gas for a lot of years, paying for university. I heard lots of rough language. I found after a while that language started to become part of my inner thoughts. And then
you're absolutely right.
Start to slip out. And that was really hard for me because I worked hard not to let things slip out like that. And you know, it's now become a inner struggle that I'm constantly holding crude sayings back in my head.
You know, it's interesting.
It's hard to get rid of it.
It's interesting as you say that, Steve, because that becomes the Christian's warfare. We're in the world. You know, if Christ didn't want us in the world, at the moment that we said, you know, I believe in Jesus, he could have whisked us to heaven. But he's left us in the world on purpose. And our experience in the world is an experience of suffering in this battle with sin. And, I mean, that's Romans 8:17 says that we're God's children, which means we're heirs of God and fellow heirs with Christ. What are we heirs of? Well, it is saying that we are heirs of the restored universe. We're heirs of the restored Eden, where we'll be kings and queens over the world with Christ under God, where we'll have his blessing, crowned with glory and honor. Really, it's the glorious rule of the saints with the Messiah. This is good. This is glorious. This is wonderful. But then it says, provided we have this inheritance, provided that we suffer with Christ in order that we may also be glorified with him. And when we think about sin, it always frustrates me to no end that Christians tend to think about sin as my own personal issue. It's not. It's a cosmic issue. And we have been called to Christ's banner to wage war against sin, because in our redemption, in our sanctification, in our overcoming sin, we are actually overcoming the world, we're overcoming Satan, and we are bringing Christ's kingdom. Now, it won't finally happen until Christ returns and we have our fully glorified bodies. And creation, the whole of creation, stands on tiptoe, longing for that day when the glory will be revealed through us. And that's the thing for Christians to understand. I said before we shouldn't toy with it. But here I even think, like, we're going to toy with it because we live in this world. When I am out and I see the movies and the TV and the bulletin boards and the magazines and all the things that are meant to entice my flesh, I get enticed because in the flesh nothing good dwells. And part of that's okay. We're to be attracted to beauty and so on. And as Al said, it's not just temptation itself that in and of itself is evil. But it's when we take that and we begin to toy with it. When we begin to say, I could be with that girl in the magazine. And then our flesh starts to respond. And we all know, you know what I'm saying? It can be in the mind. It can be in the body. And as we're doing that, we got to sit there and say, now, hold on a minute. Sin is paying its wage in death. It doesn't give us anything. It's going to give us temporary pleasure, the promise of salvation leading to damnation, the promise of a thrill leading to its killing us. And Paul says, listen, brothers, we are not debtors to the flesh to live according to the flesh. If you live according to the flesh, you'll die. But if by the Spirit you put to death the deeds of the body, you'll live. We suffer with Christ in the battle against sin. Christ suffered in the garden, drops of sweat coming down his face. He even sweat blood as he destroyed the little capillaries under his skin because of the agonies he was going through in the struggle with sin. And he went to the cross in his battle with sin. And we're in the battle with him, in the trenches with him. And that's why we need to support one another. That's what the church is all about. I get sick and tired of hypocritical, judgmental churches and joy stealers that say, tut, tut, you're bad, you don't belong here. We're all bad. We're sitting on the front lines, and sin attacks somebody, and our line gets broken and pushed back. And then the fellow soldiers say, oh, well, you're not as good as us. Ha-ha, we're good over here. Meanwhile, the enemy slips behind and stabs us in the back.
Or worse, Chad, or worse, we take the line and we move it ourselves because we just can't find anybody to stand at the line. And so we say, well, actually, the line of sin isn't there. Let's back it up.
Yes, self-righteousness.
You know, let's just, you know, really, the standard isn't perfection of Christ. The standard's going to be, well, maybe me.
Yeah.
You know, let's just be just as good as me. And then, well, I fell. Well, maybe that we should back it up. And that's where you get churches that won't even talk about sin. I think of Romans 1, which is very much talking about the slope of depravity, that if you start with the idea of, I don't need to listen to God, and therefore I'm my own God, you slip into a realm of depravity. Your foolish hearts darken, you become futile in your thinking, you worship humanity. The ultimate worship of humanity is sexuality. And then it kind of keeps going from there. You serve your lie. And your lie takes over, and then all of a sudden it becomes worse, and it talks about women exchanging natural relations for those that are contrary with nature, and men doing the exact same thing. And then it goes even worse, where people are seeing what God wants, they've absolutely rejected it, so God gives them up to what it calls a debased mind to do what ought not to be done. And then Paul just breaks it out. Now, he sees that you go from this debased mind into absolute throwing off the realm, which is why what Chad's talking about here, this idea of don't go dabble in it, don't go, even if your curiosity is piqued, even if your desire is there, what you're being led into is not simply it'll just go away. And that was the big lie that Satan told. It was this idea of just eat the apple, then you'll be able to see. He didn't let him in on all the rest.
Well, probably wasn't an apple. It's more likely a pomegranate.
Sure, all the death that will be coming through. He didn't tell him about that. And all of a sudden, you can kind of see the crest of the wave in Romans 1 on verse 29, where, and they were filled with all manner of unrighteousness and evil and covetousness and malice and envy and murder and strife and maliciousness and slanderers and gossips and haters of God and insolent and haughty and boastful and inventors of evil and disobedient. And it just, you know, and it all stems from the very beginning of Romans 1, where he talks about wanting to be their own gods, taking their own choice, messing with sin, sure, darkening their foolish hearts.
Toying with sin and suppressing the truth in order to enjoy it.
And then, just like you said, Chad, right at the end where it goes, they know God's righteous decree that those who practice such things deserve to die, though not only do they do them, but they give approval to those who practice them, which is ultimately the end of the whole conversation, because if I'm God and I get to make the rules and I get to be the one who tells everybody how to live and you tell me I'm wrong, then I must oppress you and force you to say that I'm right.
I want to turn to one quick now, just to a moment of hope in this.
Mm-hmm.
We sometimes think that we've entered the great apocalypse or something, and that this is the worst the world's ever been. Study ancient Rome.
Yeah.
It was filled with sexual violence and perversion. I'm not even going to say all the stuff they did, because this movie would probably be the norm in a rich guy's house.
Mm-hmm.
We are fast accelerating into that kind of culture. But you know what? We escaped that kind of culture before. And what did it was the power of the gospel.
Fully agree with you there, Chad. Just a bit of a cultural reference here. We have someone in our culture, a celebrity, was part of the CBC, who is being charged.
Oh, yes.
Giom Kemeshi.
Yes.
I mean, I know it's just accusations, so we're not saying that he has done these things, but he's saying it's consensual, mutual, agreed upon, rough, kinky sex, and yet he has multiple charges coming forward. So you kind of actually see a very big analogy there that based on what's come forward is that this is a guy who uses power, his wealth, to manipulate these women into those situations. I read a couple of the testimonies of the women coming forward just because I used to listen to him a lot. I really enjoyed his interviews with music celebrities and such. So I do see that this is coming in our culture. And yes, this is a scandal in Canada.
Can you see the hypocrisy in that, though? Yes. Here we fire a guy, and then we make a movie about the guy, essentially.
A similar kind of thing, yeah.
As you said, you read some of these statements that these women released, and what you see is them giving tacit consent because they're simply afraid of what he's going to do next. And so the culture goes, well, it was consensual. No, it wasn't. He manipulated them. They were terrified. They didn't know what to do, otherwise he would hit them again.
But you know, like, I can make my kids consent to clean up their room, but they don't really choose to do it.
Yeah, it's
a good point. But in all seriousness, you know what? If Comanche's done the things he's accused of, he's going to go to jail. Mm-hmm. Our culture still recognizes this is wrong, and the quote that Al read earlier says that. It says, even though they know such things are even deserving of death, they not only do them, but they celebrate those who do. We still know it's wrong, and we're going to put down some of the wrong, but we still want to delight in it. And how do we do that in our culture? We do it through our entertainment industry. Mm-hmm. We delight in the things that we don't feel we can participate in, but we still get the same thrill. We still get the same charm of sin.
Which is the word fantasy. I want to make sure that that's understood, that these women, these men are escaping into fantasy.
C.S. Lewis said, the only difference between all the great myths of the world, the Christian myth, is that the Christian myth is true. And I want to kind of use that. There's all these fantasies in the world, but Christianity has its own fantasy, and the difference is that the fantasy is true. The women who love these books, the men who love other forms of pornography, and Eve and Adam in the garden, they are looking for glory. They're looking to experience and to be like God. And yet Christianity promises that if we submit to Christ and trust in his death and resurrection, then we will receive with him the glory that Christ had before the foundation of the world. The glory that was given to Adam and Eve in the garden will be our glory, and the fantasy becomes our reality.
I don't want to wait for that. I want it now, Chad.
Do you know what picture the Bible gives us to tell us what that experience of glory is like, with the union of the church with Christ and his glory is like? According to Paul in Ephesians chapter 5, it's the sexual union between a man and a woman. Do you see what this is actually about? Is it's a false gospel. It's a sick, twisted allegory of the gospel in sin, the false gospel of sin. The whole movie, the whole enticement of this poor girl, the whole inner goddess, the whole game, and Christians are toying with this? But we have hope because we have a true fantasy that will lead to true glory that actually is given the imagery of the sexual union. The very thing that sin is promising us, we can have the reality of. And that's why we want to join in the fellowship of the church. Just like in the Lord of the Rings, the people get together and form a band of brothers and accomplish this task that leads to suffering and challenge, and they are enticed. Frodo is enticed by the ring and everyone else who has it, and yet they work their way through because they have this goal in mind. And that's what our Christian life with this kind of thing is supposed to be about. If we are trapped, if someone listening to us has got into these books and they love these books and it's sucked into their heads, they're in a bad relationship and they're being abused, if they're into other forms of pornography and they feel enslaved to it, the reality is that if Christ sets you free, you'll be free indeed. And he does that partly by giving us his Spirit and bringing us into the new age of the Spirit, where we begin to be transformed and changed, and our minds and heart are changed, and by putting us in the church, the community of the Spirit, where those who are spiritual come to those who are fallen and restore them in love and gentleness, where we are as a team and a fellowship in Christ, suffering with him, that we may also be glorified in him. We have hope, we have power, and we have the ultimate fantasy waiting for us, the true fantasy, and we don't want to exchange it for the lie.
Ours is better.
Yeah. Yeah, the message isn't suffer because just deprive yourself. The message is, no, don't take the lie, take the real deal.
We're about to close, and the bus is almost ready to get to where we're going. We're just coming around the corner here. Can I say one last thing?
Absolutely.
Some guys out there, because I know there's some guys out there that are going to argue with this. And so I want you to understand the importance of not being violent to your ladies, guys. not an a sexual lifestyle that is just an alternative form.
Here, Al, we gotta get off the bus. Keep talking as we walk.
Okay. Hold on. Oh, man.
All right, we're past those two young girls. You can tell us the story now.
Okay. So, listen. God hates the one who loves violence. Psalm 11:5. 2 Timothy 3. You are to avoid abusive and brutal people who love pleasure more than God. Ephesians 4. Talk about how no corrupt talk should come from your mouth. Verbal abuse and profanity is corrupt talk. Husbands, you're told in Colossians 3, love your wives, do not be harsh with them. Ephesians 5, love your wives as Christ loved the church. One of the qualifications of an elder, which is what we're all aspiring to, is to not be violent but gentle.
And just to clarify that, Al, what you mean by that is the qualifications for elders, the only unique thing about them is that they're not unique. They're the characteristics every Christian is called to, and the elder exemplifies.
Exactly. Now, if you're reading this stuff, you are clearly not respectable as you're meant to be. I just want to make sure that we understand that this is not something that Scripture anywhere will espouse. You know, any kind of argument you will see where men are allowed to abuse their wives or men are allowed to force their wives into submission because of the Bible is absolute garbage.
Unbiblical.
It's absolute garbage.
And you know, you talk about the whole respectable thing. You know, I've seen mothers reading this while I'm out with my little daughter in her dance class. And they're sitting there. I didn't know what this was before. Now I can never look him in the eyes again. But they're sitting right beside me reading this book. And they just go, hey, can I sit here? I do, sure. And they sit down 2 feet from me and sit. It's a respectable sin in our culture. But can you imagine if I went in there with, like, I don't know what's modern today, but like a penthouse? Hey, can I sit here, you know?
Yeah. Okay, you know what? We're about to walk into this place. Okay, Steve, I have one rule. You know, I understand that last time you were into this place, a butterfly landed on your head. You freaked out and you ran away. We're not doing that today, okay? We're not doing that today.
Let me hold the curtain open for you guys. Come on in.
There's another book! Okay, we're not sitting over there. We're sitting over there.
There are two sides. There's a beautiful garden walk to our left, and we've just entered into the butterfly conservatory. And I love this. Look at these beautiful wings. And they land on the fruit, and they eat it. Is there a fruit on your head, Steve?
Is there another one on my head again?
Actually, there are four.
Get it off! I'm out of here too! Leave him behind!
Wait, don't go out of the curtain before the butterflies come off your head. Hold them in, Al. Hold them in!
No! Leave him behind!
This has been Carnivore Theology with Chad, Al, and Steve. Thank you for listening today as we discuss 50 Shades of Grey. To find out more about Carnivore Theology, or if you have any topics or questions you want us to cover on upcoming episodes, let us know by visiting us on our website, www.carnivoretheology.com. If you like what we're doing, please like us on Facebook, rate and subscribe to us on iTunes, or subscribe to our YouTube channel. We encourage you to connect with your local biblical church and keep your eyes on the cross. How long until this bus comes?
No, we're doing the regular intro now.
Yeah, right.
You said last time, Steve.
It's one of those days. Okay. We're glad you're listening, and if you want the full edited, muchly edited, and shorter audio version, visit www.carnivoretheology.com.
What's with this editing? We don't need any editing.
Editing. We're professionals.
Welcome to Carnivore Theology, a podcast that answers questions about the Christian faith to help you grow from milk to meat into wise, skilled, world-following...
world-following changers of Jesus!
World-following changers of Jesus, oh yeah.
In my head I was like, don't do that, and it came out.
Start again.
World-changing followers of Jesus.
Cell phone. I heard a cell phone.
That's Steve Stacks to me.
Steve! All right, let's sit in the back. Now we're sitting in the back. Don't forget to count on the way. Don't look like you're counting. We're going to count on the way.
There's one!
It's pretty awkward to add the number now.
I haven't even said my line. Okay, ready? We're at 14 already.
Nanun, cuatro chile gallo!
Okay.
Maybe that's his entire problem right there.
Crap, I need to stop the podcast now.